Hello, welcome to the Pyramid Podcast with three lads discuss all things English football pyramid. On today's episode, Thomas Tuchel's the new England manager. Should a foreign manager be in charge of the Three Lions? Trent Alexander-Arnold's rumoured to be favouring a move to Real Madrid over a new Liverpool contract. The Premier League's back. We'll preview some of the big games this weekend and we'll finish with a roundup of the EFL and non-league stories where we'll finish with a Yeovil Town check-in with Laura. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Well, we want to start with Thomas Tuchel, New England manager. Laurie, which side of the fence do you sit on this kind of social media debate that seems to be happening? Happy we've brought in a serial winning coach versus he isn't English and England should be managed by an Englishman?
I'm very much on the side of the fence that I'm really happy that we've got him. I don't think anyone doubts Thomas Tuchel's coaching credentials, do they? He's clearly a very good coach in the modern day. He's managed some big clubs. He'll be a big personality, which I think is good for England. Obviously, we've got some of the biggest players in the country and players that play in some of the biggest teams. So that's important as well. And he's a winner. You know, he won the Champions League with quite an average Chelsea side a couple of years ago. So he's good in tournament football and maybe he's got what we need just to get us over the line. And in terms of the not being English thing, I 100% understand people's reluctance to accept that. It would be amazing if we had someone of Thomas Tuchel's stature that was English, but we don't. And for me personally, some of my earliest English memories or childhood England memories was Sven-Goran Eriksson in charge, and that didn't bother me one bit. If you look at the cricket, when we won the Ashes in 05, for instance, Duncan Fletcher was the manager. I think he was Zimbabwean. I know Eddie Jones didn't win anything with England, but we brought him in for the rugby. He was an Australian and did quite well and took us to a final or two. So it doesn't seem to matter in other sports. So, yeah, would it be great to have an Englishman? Yes, it would, but I'm not precious about that at all. And I think Thomas Tuchel is the right man at the right time. And I'm really excited for World Cup 2026 already.
Tomo, on that argument about sort of it being a foreign manager, Pep Guardiola was being kind of muted as potentially someone who was mulling over an opportunity to take the England job, and I didn't really see as much backlash around that. Do you think there's anything in the fact that Thomas Tuchel's German rather than, say, like Spanish, like Pep, that there's a little bit more criticism around that?
Well, yeah, it pissed off all the sort of the right wing Daily Mail reader types, didn't it? And those are the type of people who will be very much of the opinion that we had a war with Germany 60, 70, 80 years ago. And without getting all political about it, yeah, those are the type of people that would get pissed, like are easily triggered about stuff like that. But I can see the argument, but not for that point, not for the Daily Mail point of view. I can see the argument in the sense that the premise of international football is your best players from your country face our best players from our country, and we decide, we play each other at football and we decide who's the best team. Now, should that extend to the coach and the manager? Obviously, there's nothing in the rules to say it shouldn't, so there's nothing wrong with that, but there is a stat out there that no manager has ever won the World Cup not managing their own country. The only manager who has ever won a Euros or a World Cup not managing their own country was a German. So that's a good sign for England. And that was the German who managed the Greeks' Euro success in 2004. But yeah, it sparks a debate, I guess, is what is the premise of international football? Is it your best coaches against our best coaches, your best players against our best players, or is it let's just get the best man in the job? Because actually, I completely agree with everything that Laura just said. Thomas Tuchel is probably, outside of Pep Guardiola, he is the best candidate for the job. And if you take into consideration the fact that Guardiola is currently a Man City manager, is he really a candidate? So Thomas Tuchel is probably the best candidate for the job. But the fact that he's German, should it matter? At the moment, it doesn't matter. But the proof will be in the pudding. If he goes and wins the World Cup and a German masterminds England's first World Cup victory since 1966, then I'm sure all of those Daily Mail reading, right-wing nationalists will cheer and support and drink beer down the pub and support the England World Cup win.
Yeah, Definitely. Laura, I hadn't even thought about other sports with it. There doesn't ever seem to be focus on it, does there? Like, you don't ever see them zoomed in on Eddie Jones to see if he's singing the national anthem at England rugby games. And we got Brendan McCullum in the cricket now. You know, he doesn't get zoomed in on. They're not really down on the pitch front, I guess. They're sort of set up in the stands, so there's less focus on it. But even with like Lee Carsley, it was like, oh, an Irishman's in charge. You know, should he be singing the national anthem when we're taking on Ireland and all that sort of thing? So there seems to be a lot of focus more about they're like, they need to be patriotic about it. But surely the job of the manager is more about coaching this incredibly talented set of players we've got to get over the final hurdle, which Southgate unfortunately couldn't do.
Yeah, like Tegel said, it's about our best 11 players against another country's best 11 players. That's still the case. Do you know what I mean? Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, I think, was our strikers coach for the for the Euros that just went. Do you know what I mean? He's Dutch. No, I know there's like, where do you stop it? But I don't remember anyone being bothered about Sven. I know we were only young, but I'm sure there was one or two. But like you just said with the Greeks, if they were managed by a German, no one looks back and thinks, ah, no, that Euro 2004 don't count because a German was in charge. No one would have even known that. So it's just a non-story, I think. The only thing I did hear, and I haven't even thought about this, is if we get Germany in the World Cup final, is Thomas Tuchel going to be thinking, win-win, not that arsed if we lose? That's one thing you can't understand. But then you've got to think, I suppose, to get to the top of your game, you know, you'd expect the managers to have a certain level of selfishness and narcissism and rather themselves do well. And Thomas Tuchel's in a position as well, actually, where, to be honest, he's just been sacked by Chelsea and Bayern Munich kind of back-to-back, hasn't he? Probably wants his next job to be a good one and a successful one to maybe restore a little bit of credit in that regard. And that makes me think he's had a look at England for 18 months. We've got a World Cup, and I think they've got the best crop of players in the world, or one of them, and we've got a great chance, and that's positive as well.
Tommy, just on his reign and when it starts as well, am I right in saying that he's like not going to be there for the final Nations League game in November, and then we've got like draws for like World Cup qualifiers and stuff like that, but he's actually not till the start of next year taking over, is that right?
Yeah, he starts on January the 1st, but I mean, I don't know why he's starting on January 1st, but I'm only assuming it has something to do with some contractual obligations with Bayern, because he's still technically getting paid by Bayern, and I guess the FA don't want to pay him out of that contract unnecessarily. And they've just, well, they said in the press conference that their sole focus is this World Cup campaign. So they're letting Lee Carsley do this Nations League. And then for the next 18 months, it is a sole focus on the World Cup qualifiers and the World Cup. It doesn't really matter if he starts in a month's time or in January. The next two games are against Finland and Ireland, I think. Like, who gives a flying fuck?
And also, like, he's not going to be in the dugout and he might not be taking training, but I promise you he's starting now. Like, I promise you he's not just ignoring the England players and everything around it for the next 3 months. It's not just, I fancy a couple of beers at Christmas and we'll get going in January. Like Thomas said, there'll be some underlying reason it's officially in January, but he'll be getting to work and preparing now. So I think that's a bit of a non-story, really.
I actually think one of his fixtures is Greece away, and he probably don't want to go to Greece and get slapped up in Athens, because they completely took us apart, didn't they, in the recent fixture. And I don't think we're going to therefore win that Nations League group, and we're in Group B of that anyway. So he's probably thinking, look, Carsley, you can be the fall guy for that lump of shit, and I'll take over from the new year. Just before we come on, because I want to discuss a little bit about other England managers who maybe would have been in the running for it, apparently they had a 10-man shortlist. But Lauro, his number two has been appointed, which is Anthony Barry. Why would he be someone that the Pyramid podcast would have a bit of an affinity for?
Anthony Barry played for Yeovil at Wembley, actually, in the playoff final in 2007 against Blackpool, where we lost to a Keegan Parker halfway line lob, and someone scored a free kick for Blackpool. It's either Michael Jackson or Robbie Williams. I can't remember which of the two, but someone had the same
name. A mixture of the two.
Maybe. Someone scored a free kick for Blackpool and the name was like a singer. But anyway, Anthony Barry played for us that day. He was a good player, but he had a really bad injury and ended up kind of more in the non-league, I think. But, I mean, you'd have heard his name around loads. I think he goes around with Thomas Tuchel. I think he was involved with Portugal, maybe, with Bobby Martinez or someone.
Do you boys know how he got his sort of first Premier League gig, basically he was taking his pro license at exactly the same time as Frank Lampard and Jody Morris. And they were so impressed with him. He was sort of seen as the top of the class in that coaching course that they took him on to Chelsea when Frank Lampard and Jody Morris took that job. And then Thomas Tuchel come in after Frank Lampard. And basically, he was so impressed with him as well. He took him, he basically made him stay, had to fight for him to stay. And then I think he took him to Bayern. Like you just said, he's been at Portugal with Bobby Martinez, and now he's going to be assistant manager with England. So I think it was important as well that Thomas Tuchel brought in an English manager, assistant manager, just to sort of ease those doubts and worries, and just for the optics of it, even though I think all of that is fluff and bollocks, but he's clearly a very highly thought of coach.
The only thing is, I'm pretty sure, if I remember rightly, Anthony Barry's quite scouse, and the Liverpool people don't say they're English, do they? They're a different country altogether. But yeah, interesting points though about Andy Barry, because, like, I mean, it's a long time ago now, but it was quite an unassuming type player. It'd be interesting to see behind the scenes, because everyone used to say Steve Holland was a great coach as well, but you never hear from these people, so you'd never get a grip of what they'd like and how they'd get a message across and stuff like that. So I'd be interested to see an Anthony Barry training session, but considering he's been at Chelsea, Ireland, Belgium, Portugal, Bayern Munich, and now England, he must be very good at it. So well done, Anthony.
Yeah, he's mainly a set piece coach, but I think this assistant role obviously will be taken on way more than that. But yeah, he's been mainly deployed as a set piece coach under Tuchel.
Yeah, good gig for him though. It struck me because I was getting out the car the other day and they had Mark Bertram on one of the TalkSport shows, and they were like, oh, they'll talk about one of his former teammates, Anthony Barry. I didn't think anything of it. And then I thought, actually, would that have been Glover's, where they were teammates? Would their have careers sort of aligned then at Yeovil around that time? Sort of was it 2006, do you say, Laura?
Yeah, well, Anthony Barry was our replacement, believe it or not, for Lee Johnson when we sold him to Hearts. And he was a little centre-mid, good ball-playing centre-mid. And I remember him playing at Wembley, but he got injured. But yeah, it would have been kind of that Russell Slade era at Yeovil. So yeah, probably was Mark Bertram teammates with him then, yeah.
Just quick point I want to address as well. Obviously, the criticisms of the FA for appointing a German manager, like from the likes of, I don't know, the right-wing people and the sort of Daily Mail readers, and it's some of it sort of undertoned with racism and xenophobia and all that stuff. But actually, some of it is justified in the sense that if you actually look at the coaching badges courses in England and you compare that to Spain, I think I just read an article then. In 2017, there was like 15,000 qualified coaches in Spain. And that's because if to qualify for the A license, it's like €400. And to qualify for the pro license, it's like €1,600. And then if you compare that to England's and the FA's coaching courses, I think to get your pro license in England is over £10,000. So in terms of this coaching pathway that sort of come under a bit of scrutiny because we've hired a German coach, it starts there. Do you know what I mean? I think there's only 2,000 English qualified pro license coaches. And the reason is because it's fucking £10,000 to bloody apply and to get. That these barriers need to be stripped down in order for the to get more coaches involved, and then you'll see more high level English coaches.
But how many English coaches are actually having to get the £10,000 out of their own pocket? Like, a lot of coaches now are like ex players, aren't they? Like, you know, I just thinking of a few off the top of my head, like sort of Lampard and Scott Parker and people like that. They're just going to have that paid for during the last years of their playing career, working towards their coaching badges. Like, how many top level English coaches are there?
But I completely agree with what you just said there. But that's that pathway of basically going in from professional footballer into coaching has always been there. But we're talking about the sort of the level where we're at, like normal people like us. In Spain, the pathway for normal people like us to become a football coach is way easier. And then you can sort of develop a career, progress a career, and then hopefully go up the levels. So normal people like us, the barriers are there in England, and that's the difference. That's the difference. Yeah, and
I completely agree. I get that. My point being, I'd love to know, right, that's fine. It costs a lot less in Spain to get your pro license, but how many top level Spanish coaches have we got who haven't got a career in as a football player to begin with? How many have started off at 18 being rubbish at football or not playing football and thinking, actually, I don't want to play, I want to be a coach. And they've gone through that career pathway and now are managing at the top level. And I know we probably don't have the answer off the top of our heads here, but I'd like that analysis on top of that of, look, it costs more to do it in the UK, but actually, are we seeing the proof in the pudding that it's a lot cheaper in Spain and countries like that? And here are examples of top level coaches who've not had a career in the game before.
I agree with you, but this article basically says that there was over 15,000 qualified coaches in Spain compared to England, which was 1,700. So when you're just talking about a numbers game, it's quite clear that among those 15,000 Spanish coaches, there's going to be more likely to be more highly qualified and more highly competent coaches. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get it. I get the point.
That's the big issue for me.
So let's talk about the England coaches then. I tried to sort of have a look through the top level English coaches. Obviously, Gareth Southgate was one of them, but was the previous manager. And then you're looking at like Eddie Howe, but Eddie Howe's come out and said he wasn't on the FA 10-man shortlist. I don't know whether that's true or not. Graham Potter, out of work, might have been on there. And then from there, I was really struggling. I wrote down Lee Carsley because he was in the role, but he's Irish. So I was struggling then, Laurie, to think of the top level coaches who England potentially could have employed, who would be an Englishman that some fans would want.
Yeah, I think most people, I think we would think along the lines of Eddie Howe or Graham Potter, weren't we? I'd rather Thomas Tuchel. Do you know what I mean? Eddie Howe, if he was more available, would be a good shout. But still, not sure he's done what Thomas Tuchel has. He's won the Champions League and he's managed the top, like the very top teams in Europe. Instrumental in persuading Harry Kane to leave the Premier League to go to Bayern Munich. Lots of big things at the top of the game that he's been involved with. I think he's just the best coach. And, you know, maybe next time it will be Eddie Howe or it will be an English coach. But I'm not sure I'd like to know who the 10 candidates were that were interviewed, actually. I'd be interested to know the names of those people. Maybe if they were made public, it would make Thomas Tuchel look a much more sensible choice to those people that aren't sure.
Yeah, well, that list will definitely not be made public because I guarantee half of those people are probably already in jobs. Do you know what I mean? But I think if you listen to, like, Harry Redknapp come out, didn't he, on Talk Sport, and he absolutely slated the decision to appoint a German. And he said that we should have appointed Frank Lampard or Steven Gerrard or Wayne Rooney. And it's like, these are the three biggest examples of sort of English legendary players who've gone into management. All three have been given opportunities, maybe not Wayne Rooney in the Premier League, but obviously Lampard and Gerrard have both been given massive opportunities in the Premier League and they haven't pulled up trees. Do you know what I mean? And Steven Gerrard's out in Saudi now, so I'd write him off completely. And so I don't know where this argument is. Like you said, really, the only two strong, realistic targets would have been Howe and Potter. Potter more so maybe because he's out of a job. But like Laura says, Tuchel's just more qualified, probably better suited for the job. The only thing that doesn't suit him for the job is the fact that he hasn't got an English passport. That's it.
Yeah. That's an absolutely senile suggestion from Harry Redknapp. That is literally, he's actually doing the argument of having an English coach harmed by suggesting that, because he's saying it's more important to be English than to be qualified. Because Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard aren't qualified to be manager of England. And Wayne Rooney's currently managing Plymouth. I think he's got probably the best chance of going the furthest out of those three as it stands at the moment, but not ready to be the England manager, for God's sake. No, let's let Thomas have his chance now, and I'm sure it will be successful.
Well, I think that's a fairly comprehensive steer from all of the pod members about happy with the decision, and I'm also, we've got a world-class coach in rather than we should be led by an Englishman. So we can move on from that one. And I want to talk about one of the England players actually next, Trent Alexander-Arnold. So heard on the radio a debate earlier in the week, which was around the fact that he's in the last year of his contract, apparently rumoured to be favouring a move to Real Madrid. I know previously he was kind of tasked with getting Bellingham over to Liverpool and sort of being an agent in England camps. It's actually worked out that they've got that close that Jude's gone to Real Madrid, and it looks like Trent now wants to link up with him at the Bernabeu. But Tomo, what I want to understand is, if you're Trent Alexander-Arnold, obviously probably already a Liverpool legend and an academy boy, do you think there's like almost like an onus on him for him to say now, look, I am going to go to Real Madrid, and therefore if the club wants to recoup some money for me, it needs to be in January, because, you know, if he had a 5-year contract, he's probably a £100 million player? Or do you think in his head, he's just thinking about the fact that he can go on a free transfer like so many players are doing now, get that transfer fee, in inverted commas, in the means of a signing on fee and a bigger wage?
I don't know. It's hard to sort of put yourself into the mindset of like Scousers, basically. It's a different, they're a different breed up there, aren't they? They're, the loyalty that they have, and it's not like, say if Steven Gerrard, when he was on that private plane going to Chelsea and he sort of bottled it, it's not like that, because Liverpool, okay, they did win the Champions League, but they weren't really at the level that this Liverpool were at. Like basically challenging for everything all the time, because they're one of the top clubs in Europe. So, and also I think they would find it very difficult to forgive him for leaving for free, because he's obviously that level of player where if he was on if he had 3 years left on his contract, he would be 100 million, 150 million type of player. So, but on the other hand, and playing devil's advocate, it's bloody hard to turn down Real Madrid. He's got, 8-9 months left on his contract. He's going to get a massive signing bonus. He'll be one of the highest paid players in Spain. And it fits, because Dani Carvajal, he's just had a season-long injury. He's coming to the end of his career. That team, that Real Madrid team, just seems such an exciting young squad of players. And they will be challenging for La Liga and Champions League every single year. So I think it's a really tough decision for him. I'm really struggling to see him say no to that, to be honest.
Yeah, I think he has to go. If I'm Trent, I'm 1,000,000% going to Real Madrid. He's already played 250 games for Liverpool. He's already won everything. And sort of the opposite to Real Madrid, who've got a young sort of up-and-coming squad with full of world-class players already, Liverpool's best crop of players are coming to the end. You know, your Van Dijk's, your Salah's, even your Alisson's, a lot of their best players are older now and have already achieved, and they're not going to be able to replenish them the same way that Real Madrid have, with like your Vinicius's and your Mbappe's, etc. And the fact that Trent is still only 26, he could go on and have just as good a career now and do everything that he's done with Liverpool with Real Madrid again. It's not often you get the chance to do this at such a good age, having already achieved everything with Liverpool. It's not like he's got unfinished business. He's won the Champions League and the Premier League, and he's been involved in the most successful era for Liverpool probably since the 70s and 80s. So he's absolutely got to go. And I'm sure behind the scenes, one way or another, he's told them what he wants to do. And it's on Liverpool now to decide how they work that business-wise and financially to get the best deal for them. But I think he's 100% got to go. No brainer.
Just to make one point as well, actually, because Real Madrid seem to be the best club in the world at convincing players to run down their contract and get them for free. You, like in any other walk of life, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Liverpool would have come to an agreement before this year. I know maybe Klopp leaving last year would have complicated the issue a little bit, but he's that level of player and obviously a local player. You would have thought 3 years before the end of his contract, they would have been in talks with getting a new contract, or 2 years at least. So it feels like, because the contract is getting to this late stage, like Laura's just said, maybe they've already had the conversation and maybe it's like, no, I'm going.
What I don't get, though, and it's kind of building on your point there, Tomo, is I don't know when Trent last signed a contract or a contract extension, but let's say he's been on a 4 or 5 year deal on the same wages and this is now running down that contract, because I can't imagine he's been on like 1 or 2 year deals. Why are they not 2 years ago? Everyone knew what Trent was about then. They were winning trophies then. He was, you know, some say unfairly not in the England side, but was absolutely fundamental to them, and everyone knew he was like a world-class player. Why are Liverpool then not making him like Liverpool captain or putting him on the wages that your Salahs and Van Dijks are now? How has it got to the stage where, and look, it might be a year ago they were starting to do this and he said, look, we're not coming. But I can't imagine someone 3 years out on their deal starts running it down thinking I'm going to Real Madrid in 3 years' time. But, so I just can't understand how the Liverpool hierarchy have got to this situation where they are now.
It does seem incompetent, like, to put it bluntly, but like I just said before, Real Madrid seem to be so good at doing this and squad planning, and they would have probably had the conversation with Trent Alexander's people 3 years ago and said, look, Danny Carvajal's coming to the end of his career. Like, they're almost floating the idea with Trent's entourage and agents or whoever it might be 3 years down the line. So it might just be that Liverpool have had no encouragement from Trent or his agent that he wants to sign a new deal. And what can they do? Their hands are tied behind their back. You can't force a player to stay.
I also think, if you think back 2 years ago, as you just suggested, like specifically 2 years ago, there's actually quite a lot of optics going on that Trent can't defend and he can't play right back anymore. And he's going to have to move into midfield. And he's had a bit of a renaissance now whereby everyone's sort of stopped messing around and thought, actually, this guy is unbelievable. We might not be, you know, a right back in terms of his defensive duties, but in terms of what he gives going forward from that position, we need to realise that he's a world-class talent and he sort of finds himself back in the England squad again. But there was a little bit of a dip in stock, I think, for Trent a couple of years ago, and that might have made Liverpool hesitant to go massive on him then as well and just sort of see what happens. But that will obviously, if that is the case, that will obviously bite him in the backside now because, you know, a very talented player who's obviously going to be wanted by everyone. And if he goes to Real Madrid, I just think that'd be the best place for him. I think he'll marvel over there and we'll be looking at it from an England point of view, especially as Kyle Walker's getting older now, and be very happy that our right back plays week in, week out for the Galacticos.
I do think, Murph, before you come in quickly, I do think it is a bigger deal for a Scouser to leave Liverpool, like a local lad to leave Liverpool, than any other club, to be honest. And he probably would have looked at how maybe Steve McManaman's treated now or how Michael Owen's almost seen as a bit of a...
Yeah, that was the United move, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's... And I also get the point of Lauro saying, look, but Trent has been sort of the last 8 years or however long he's been in the first team, he's won every single trophy he could win and he's been massively successful. So maybe that might change things slightly, but I do think it's almost a bigger hurdle to cross when you leave Liverpool as a Scouser.
Right, let's put this then, and I get that point around being a Scouser might be a little bit different, but let's put ourselves in Trent's shoes. Obviously, we've got two United fans and a Leeds fans, all born and bred. You can tell that from Lauro's Yorkshire accent and our Manc accent, Tomo's. But Lauro, you play for Leeds. You've been there 8 years. You've won everything that you can with Leeds. You're coming into the final 6 months of your deal. Their holding mid has just got injured and obviously you're world-class in that position. Would you move in January for 40 mil on 300 grand a week if the deal came in, which meant that Leeds recoup 40 mil for you? Or would you run down your contract so you get that 40 mil in a signing on fee and maybe slightly higher wages? Would you have that affinity to your club to try and recoup money?
If it was down to me, I'd make sure the club got money. 100%, I think Trent would as well. Like, but it probably isn't down to him, is it? You've got to admit, there's agents involved. There's so many people involved in making these deals happen. And I expect a lot of the time the player's just told, you know, when to act or when to say something, when to sign something. It's not going to be him saying, no, I'm running down the contract. Yeah, Real Madrid might be confident that he will run down his contract and aren't even offering any money in January. Do you know what I mean? They might be thinking, no, don't worry. He ain't signing a new deal there. We've already sorted it with him. So have him for the last 4 months of the season, then we'll take him for free. It's not necessarily Trent's decision. If it is, I'm sure he'd want Liverpool compensated. But I think it's more likely that it'll be a contract rundowner, to be honest with you.
Yeah, nothing to add. No notes.
Fair enough. I would run it right down. I'd get the bag. I'd secure that 40 mil. I'd shove my thumb up as I got driven out of Old Trafford. So, yeah, but we'll see what happens. I'm intrigued to see with that, because I can see both possibilities there on him signing a new deal and being announced as captain. The other point I would just make is maybe he's just seeing they've had this massive sort of cycle under Klopp of it. I wonder whether Klopp leaving's almost said, like, is that starting to point towards the end of the era? Mane's gone, Firmino's gone, Salah may go in the summer, Van Dijk potentially not getting any younger could get a move. Alisson, Andy Robertson. I wonder whether he's just seeing that cycle coming to a natural conclusion and thinks now's the time for me to strike and go and become a Galactico. So, yeah, be intrigued to see what decision he takes there. Let's look ahead to some of the Prem fixtures, and we'll start with Liverpool. They take on Chelsea. Obviously, Liverpool, top of the league, had a great start under Arne Slot. And I think in years gone by, it would be a bit of a banker them home to Chelsea with how Chelsea have been. But Laura, you've been particularly impressed with Chelsea going forward so far this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that game is one of the biggest games in the Premier League for a long time, just in terms of the overall kind of the wider context, if you like, of the landscape of it, because we've all been thinking about Man City and Arsenal as the sort of two top dogs, really, for a couple of years now. I think we're starting to feel like Liverpool might be hanging on in there, and actually on slots managed to not have a hangover and sort of keep the continuity going, and they're going to be up there. And Chelsea, I don't think they will be Liverpool, and I don't think they will get 3 points from this fixture. But if they back up their start to the season with 3 points against Liverpool, with the players that they've got, they've always been good looking on paper. They've always looked a side on paper. It's just not happened on the field up until this season. If they can go and rubber stamp that with a massive win at Anfield on Sunday, I think you've probably got to start thinking about them as trouble in the top of the right at the top of the division, rather than sort of top four to top six. So, stark contrast to what I was saying at the start of the season, where I didn't think they'd make the top eight, because they've been scintillating so far, certainly going forward, and they seem to be getting the most out of a lot of the players that they've got at the moment. And I think the overriding feeling, probably even with Chelsea fans, but definitely the neutrals, is at some point they're going to come. There's going to come a sticky spell. They'll come unstuck, but it hasn't happened yet. And if, like I said, if they go to Anfield and get 3 points, that'll be absolutely massive. Having said that, I don't think they will. And I think it'll end up being probably quite a good day for Liverpool and maybe sending them further clear at the top. But massive, massive game, and one that's probably a lot more, carries a lot more weight than it has done in recent years in terms of the title shake-up or maybe the top three.
Tomo, two sides who seem to be like quite attacking, especially how Chelsea are playing, and we know what Liverpool are like at home as well. So a fixture that might carry some goals as well for everyone.
Well, yeah, I agree. The thing is with this, like Laura says, it is one of the most exciting games of the season, just because basically it feels like both teams are in great form. But actually, when you look at, you kind of judge their form based off their fixture lists, and actually both of them have had pretty favourable fixture lists. And if you look at their fixture list coming up, this will be the sort of true test of how well and how far these two teams can challenge, especially when you look at Liverpool's. I think their next sort of 10, 12 games is like unbelievably hard. One of the biggest battles in this fixture in particular, I'm particularly interested in, will be Ryan Gravenberch versus Cole Palmer, because you've got Ryan Gravenberch, who I think has been the surprise performer of the season. He's been unbelievable, really. And when you consider that Liverpool were clearly trying to sign Zubimendi in the summer, they back Gravenberch, but when you're so actively trying to sign someone in his position, they obviously thought he needed help. But his performances this season for Liverpool and for Holland have far outweighed anything I thought he was capable of. So that's, and he's obviously plays in a position where he'll be coming up against Cole Palmer, and like, we don't really need to talk about how exciting he is. He's Chelsea's main man. He's been unbelievable again this season. So yeah, that's the battle I'm most looking forward to on Sunday.
Yes, I've seen as well that Moise Caicedo has been getting a lot of praise for his Chelsea performances. Apparently did really well on international duty as well. So starting to look a bit stronger in midfield now, Chelsea as well. So yeah, I'm intrigued by that game. And Liverpool will be looking to extend their lead at the top of the table. Couple of away fixtures for the other main protagonists. Arsenal are at Bournemouth at 5:30. A couple bits of injury news for them. Arteta said that Saka's injury is not too serious. He's evolving very well in training. We're hopeful, which might Mike kind of earmarked that he could be started. And he's also said Kai Havertz could be involved this weekend if all goes to plan in training today. So, yeah, I think that Arsenal will be going to Bournemouth looking to get all 3 points, and that will only be aided by Saka and Havertz being available. And then City go to Wolves. Obviously, Wolves, I think they're rock bottom or joint rock bottom on 1 point. So not a very nice fixture for Gary O'Neill. And yeah, I can't imagine anything other than a City large victory there, which could spell the end for Gary O'Neill, actually. One other game I want to touch on is United versus Brentford, which is, to be honest, a mid-table battle. But Tomo, probably quite surprised that Erik ten Hag's still in a job off the back of the international break. And with news that Kobbie Mainoo's injured, Ugarte's got injured for Uruguay, I'm really not looking forward to checking my phone after footy on Saturday and seeing what Brentford have done to us.
Yeah, and if you cast your mind back to this fixture last year, I think Brentford were 2-1 up going into the sort of 89th minute, and Scott McTominay came on and scored two in the last 5 minutes to save our bacon really there. And if you also then cast your mind back to the start of the season when we played Brentford in Brentford Stadium, and they were 4-0 up at half time. So it feels like United have struggled a little bit against Brentford. So I fully expect to struggle again. Thomas Frank is probably one of the most impressive managers in the Premier League. I don't know whether that's because he's at the perfect club, at the perfect time, and at the perfect level, but he's one manager who I'd love to see at a bigger club, given an opportunity to sort of see if he can further his career in that sense. But whenever you ask him that question, I think his name was bandied about when Tottenham were there, and obviously his name's been bandied about whenever Man United have looked for a new coach, or even when Erik ten Hag's in situ. He's always said, no, like, I love Brentford, this is the job for me, and this is my only focus. And the conversations he has around that is so impressive. I think he'd be really interesting appointment for Man United if Erik ten Hag eventually does get sacked.
Laura, I said I was surprised that he wasn't sacked, Erik ten Hag. From a more neutral point of view, we were expecting United to pull the trigger on him leaving in the international break, given there was this high-profile meeting that was taking place in London. Were you expecting a new manager to be in the dugout for this game?
Yes. I thought it would be a bad story. I thought they just... it clearly hasn't worked with Erik ten Hag, and I cannot believe they can't see that it's clearly not going to. You're going to keep being a mediocre sort of top-half Premier League side rather than challenging for anything serious, and I just think everyone knows that now, and I'm sure they know that themselves, but it just, the question is, why wait? I kind of understand it in the summer, because they just had the FA Cup win, and this was going to be their first season in the sort of in total control, but he isn't doing a good enough job and has to go. I really like Thomas Frank as a manager, but I actually think that job would be a bit big for him to go sort of from Brentford being the biggest job he's ever had before to go into Man United. I think he could do with like a club somewhere in between first before taking on a job that big, but definitely needs to be someone else at the helm soon. And I thought it should have been this time last year, let alone the international break just gone. So yeah, when they're going to do it, I don't know, but surely it's got to be sooner rather than later.
It is just a matter of time. And if you think about when managers get to this sort of level of scrutiny, and almost it does feel like he's a dead man walking. And are there any examples recently of a manager getting this far sort of down in the level of the level of performances that he's putting on the pitch, and then do they turn it around? And some might say, well, Klopp didn't start well at Liverpool, or Arteta didn't start that well at Arsenal, and they had their struggles. But when you sort of compare, it's like comparing apples and oranges. Actually, Klopp's team was scoring goals for free, and the signs were good. And I think they got to the Europa League final in the first season. Mikel Arteta, but they clearly had like a cultural issue at the club with the likes of Lacazette and Aubameyang. So he had a big job on his hands, and he was given the time and freedom to do that. Whereas it feels like even though Ten Hag has won the League Cup and the FA Cup, there's just too many signs that it's just never going to work. So, it feels like he's a dead man walking.
Jurgen Klopp went in at Liverpool in 2015 and then won the Champions League in his third season. And they were competing at the top of the league as well. Do you know what I mean? If Erik ten Hag is going to win the Champions League this season and compete for top of the league, then fine, keep him. But it's just the fact he's a million miles away. Arteta is probably the closest example to what you've just said in terms of, I think there was one stage at the start of the season a few years ago where it was like one more loss and it was probably out.
There were three games, three losses, bottom of the Premier League, and it was like, right, he's now done. And he got apparently he was told he had a week to save his job.
Yeah. Well, Erik ten Hag seems to have had a week to save his job about five times now. And now it's getting to the stage where if you get a draw against Villa, you keep your job. Do you know what I mean? It's like that used to be a 3 points guaranteed. Although Villa are a bit better now. It's just clear to everyone now. I don't think there's one person out there that thinks Eric's the man. So they must have a plan in place. I'm sure we'll see it unfold soon.
I thought it was going to be Tuchel that would come in. But what it tells to me is they know it's not going to work. But the manager that they want next is in a job somewhere. And they're not going to prize him away at this stage. So whether they could say, look, Rude, you got it to the end of the season. But apparently there's like a few bits about him not wanting to do that to Ten Hag and don't want it to be viewed that he was coming in to do that. But it just says to me that whoever United have earmarked for next is currently in a job and they're trying to get through to the summer with him now that it's clear that it's not going to work with Ten Hag. But look, the signs have been there for a long time with that. So be intrigued to see if his form stays bad, like through to say the next international break, whether they're just going to persevere with it until whoever they earmark for it gets the job. Bit like that Mick McCarthy meme of like, it can't go on like this, can it? And he's just like, it can. That seems to be every month as a United fan. Right, boys, let's move away from the Premier League and on to the EFL. And, Laurie, Friday night football tonight, Leeds versus Sheffield United, fifth versus second. Leeds obviously had that 97th minute heartbreak just for the international break, which I imagine has left a bit of a bitter taste for a couple of weeks. And take on Sheffield United tonight, who are currently unbeaten this year. They've won five of their last six. They've got six clean sheets in a row. They last conceded in the league in August. So I can only assume you're fully expecting Leeds to win tonight.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the toughest games. Chris Wilder generally has a bit of a chip on his shoulder whenever he faces Leeds. And they do. I remember Chris Basham scoring a goal for them the season they went up in Bielsa's first year with Leeds. And obviously we came third. So it's a difficult fixture. The only thing that's worrying me a little bit at the moment, I know I've been on record to say we're going to cruise the league and I think we will, but we've actually got both of our starting centre mids out until the new year in Ethan Ampadu, who's the captain, and Grueb. So we're playing Rothwell and Tanaka, who are obviously a new partnership and not first choice. So Sheffield United might smell blood a little bit, the fact that we might be perceived to have a soft centre. Gus Hamer is obviously in that area of the pitch and for me is the best player in the league. So they carry big threats, Sheffield United. And it wouldn't be the end of the world getting out of that with a point, I don't think, even though we're at home. But we do kind of need to recover from the 2 points we literally chucked in our own net at the Stadium of Light the other day. So I would absolutely love a win and we can do it. But this is one of the tougher games of the season for sure. So let's wait and see.
That game at the Stadium of Light where Melier made that error, I saw on someone on social media, I know this is going back a couple of weeks now, of him like laughing and joking with the Sunderland manager after the game. Was there anything from Leeds fans about that? Was that just a bit of like a social media storm in a teacup with him sort of laughing and joking after that mistake?
Who? Meslier?
Yeah. Or have you not even seen it?
No, I just... it's very, very hard to know how to react after doing something like that, isn't it? It's probably just... it's so bad that you might as well have a laugh and a joke about it. Do you know what I mean?
True.
What can you do? That's the worst goalkeeping error I've ever seen, I think. I genuinely don't think I've ever seen anything as bad as that. So what do you do? I don't know how you'd react in that situation. You must have wanted the floor to swallow him up. And if there was a button you could have pressed to make that happen, I'm sure he'd have done it. So let's not, you know, he wouldn't have slept since then. And he'll be waiting for his first save tonight, won't he, to try and get back.
Yeah, fist pump and hit the badge.
I hate that current level of like scrutiny that players are under sometimes. Like, what if that the fella who he's chatting to has just made an unbelievable joke and killed him? What is he supposed to do? Just not laugh? Like, or do you know what I mean? Like, not act like a human being. It's just, it's ridiculous. And like Laura says, that that was so bad that what else can you do but laugh?
I think as well that like the context behind it is they were either like he was his manager Melies before, or he was a coach at a club Melies was at before. So they had like a relationship. It wasn't just going up to the opposition manager and sort of fist pumping in and being like, how about that then? But yeah, I just wondered if there was any fallout from Leeds fans, who are obviously a very passionate bunch, but Laurie's not even seen it. So there we go. So on to a bit of wider EFL games. Start with the Championship. So top of table Sunderland, they go to Hull on Sunday. And at the other end of the table, strugglers Portsmouth, who are still yet to actually win a game this season, aim to pick up those first 3 points versus QPR, who are winless in five. In League One, fourth place Lincoln take on top of the table Birmingham. Birmingham actually lost their first game of the season before the international break against Charlton, away at Charlton. That was just after Laura had tipped them to be invincibles in the podcast before. It's also 8th versus 6th as Charlton welcome Stockport to the Valley. Should be a good game between two sides who are obviously promotion candidates. And then in League 2, there's actually only 3 points that separates the top 8 sides. So you've got Port Vale in first on 21 points at the top there, all the way down to Grimsby in 8th place. Some big games in that actually. 5th place Gillingham travel to 7th place Bradford. Mark Bonner's Gills have lost their previous three games, though. You've got fourth place Warsaw, who do go to eighth place Grimsby. So I'm sure League Two's leaderboard, as it does every week, can look very different come 5:30 on Saturday. Just worth also mentioning that AFC Wimbledon, they're 10th, but they have three games in hand on all of those sides above them, given the issues they've had with their pitch with the flooding. So, yeah, I wasn't expecting them to do so well, but with ex-Yeovil legend Terry Skiverton as assistant manager there, hopefully they can get their pitch back playable and get in some of those promotion places. We'll have a little mention on non-league, Loro. Let's finish with a Yeovil update, as we always do. So since the international break in our last pod, I think we've beat Dagenham and Redbridge, but we lost in the FA Cup against a side in the league below. We've had a couple of players left this week, but we're actually only, I think, 3 points off the playoffs. Look like we've got a winnable couple games coming up. So is there a bit of a backlash at the minute at Yeovil? What's the current situation?
Well, there's always a backlash unless you win 4-0 every week. You know, big high beating Dagenham and Redbridge with easily the best performance of the season, probably the best performance I've seen all calendar year from Yeovil the week before last. And then we got dumped at the FA Cup against National League South outfit Chesham last week. But that is football in a nutshell. But as you quite rightly say, we're 3 points off the playoffs. And to be quite honest with you, we've been what I would describe as quite mediocre this season. So I actually think it's a good sign that if you can be playing averagely after being promoted and actually be 3 points off the playoffs with a winnable run of fixtures coming up, that's actually a good place to be. So we have now got Wealdstone on Saturday. Next Saturday, we've got Maidenhead. And on Tuesday, we've got Tamworth away. And just on the subject of Tamworth, I'll just mention to probably wrap up for the day, ex-player George Baldock lost his life since our last podcast. Obviously, horrible news coming out of Greece over nearly 400 games, I think, in English football, many of them in the EFL and non-league setup. So obviously devastating news for the football community, and condolences to his families and thoughts are with them as well. So hopefully... yeah, hopefully the next few games will be good for Yeovil, and we'll report back in more positive thought processes next time.
Yeah, I think we can wrap up the pod there, boys. We'll be back next week where we will review all of that weekend action and look ahead to some more midweek European ties as well. But boys, pleasure as always. Cheers, chaps.
Many well done, boys. 1, 2, 3.